Hi, I'm Marion McPartland. My guest today on Piano Jazz is Skitch Henderson, pianist, conductor, and founder of the New York Pops Orchestra, with which I very happily performed a few months ago. We had a good time, and you and I played some forehands.
We played some forehands. We played some music of the Duke of Ellington, as
yes,
I recall.
Yes, we did, which we'll do today as well. Well, you were talking about your early days, and I mean, I know we can talk an awful lot of, you've got a lot of things to talk about, but you said you started in Hollywood and you roomed with Jimmy Van Heusen?
He was my roommate, yes.
That in itself.
Edward Babcock is his Christian name.
Oh, really?
Yes, he comes from Syracuse, New York, but he changed his name when he went to Hollywood and became James Van Heusen.
Goodness.
And wrote with Johnny Burke. He wrote with many people, but of course he wrote most of the big Crosby scores, Bing Crosby, the most of the films, with Johnny Burke, who, before he worked with Van Heusen, wrote a little song called Pennies from Heaven. So
not a bad tune.
The credibility line keeps going.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many of those. I'd love to hear you play one. I'm dying to hear you do a song. How about maybe something by Hoagy Carmichael?
Hoagy Carmichael, I loved, but he was an enigma to me because he was such a rounder, as you know. He was
Oh, I love that word.
He was a good friend of Jack Daniels always. You wouldn't go out there alone, would you? Was
no.
And I'd like to play a tune of his called, a melody of his called One Morning in May.
That's a great song.
Which I first played, I think, when I was a pianist in the Castellanets Orchestra. And I remember then it was a cello solo, but if cellists all over the world will forgive me their clef, I'll play it pianistically.
Love to hear it.
Thank you.
by Mr. Carmichael.
What a lovely, tender touch you have. It's beautiful. Well, you studied some pretty great people years ago, didn't you? With
Yes. Well, of course, I was...
Schoenberg?
With Schoenberg.
Actually?
Yes.
Harmony?
Yes. Yes. It was the period after World War II when he resided in Hollywood and was going to teach Jungs, as he called them, you know, with his black sweater, his lack of sunshine, any place. Mm-hmm. It's funny, he went to California and he hated sunshine. But he was very unhappy teaching. He just didn't, he had to do it to make a living at that time, and he really didn't enjoy himself. So I met him with other people, you know, that worked in the film colony, worked in the plastic factory, as we called it, and got to know him and to talk to him and used to go to his house.
What kind of things did he show you?
Well, he first said that he made strange remarks. He once said that Mozart had no talent. He's only a tremendous orchestrator.
Oh.
And I thought...
People might scream at that.
He said, you know, he used folk melodies. And you know, I mean, you couldn't argue with him about anything. But he did tell me that when he began, because then I was working at MGM, and he told me that when he began early in his life at Radio Berlin and some other station in Germany, he made orchestrations not unlike Shostakovich did on T42, that he did that for a living initially, and that's the way he started before he became so scholastic. And he said he stumbled upon a system that was confounding to the intellects.
Boy, it sure was and is. What did you do mainly in Hollywood?
I was a rehearsal pianist, and I played piano for a lot of people, and I worked in the orchestras, of course, and I did sketches, did orchestrating. I was the shadow behind the scene, never the billing, you know, in those days.
But
I worked with Bing and Bing Crosby.
Oh, terrific.
In radio, actually, not at Paramount, but in radio I worked with him, and I worked...
Frank Sinatra.
Later years with Sinatra, of course, because we had been friends since his emergence as a light baritone, is that what you say?
Yeah.
I knew him since Major Bowes. There are very few people listening who probably remember that, but it was an amateur hour of great fame in radio. And that's where Frank really started his career. And then the James Band, of course, and then the Dorsey Band. And I played piano in a funny studio orchestra we had at RCA in Hollywood. And we made the first independent recording that Sinatra ever made when he was still with the Dorsey Band.
Really? What was that?
And the tune was called... first tune he recorded,
oh my goodness.
Night and Day. And on the other side was, it was a 78, of course. And on the other side, I think, was Matt's Night We, was that?
The Night We Called It A Day.
The Night We Called It A Day. Was that
really?
Matt's song?
Matt Dennis's song.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I bet collectors would like to get their hands on that.
Wouldn't that
they?
Be wonderful? I wish I had it. And Axel Stordahl made the arrangements.
My goodness.
And we had at least, you know, 13 or 14 men. We had really a big orchestra. That was the beginning, yeah.
Well, now you... wrote something for, you were telling me, for something called Act One.
Act One. It was a heartbreaker for me because it was the story of Moss Hart. And it was Dorrie Sherry's last big effort. Dorrie Sherry, I had worked for at MGM when he was the super boss.
Mm-hmm.
And when he rang me up and said, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it in New York, because I was then music director at NBC and doing all the wonderful shows that I participated in, or not so wonderful sometimes. And he said, I'd like you to do this film. Would you like to do it? And I said, it would be a joy. And it was like old times to me. But the film really wasn't successful. It didn't work in some way. I don't know. I mean, there are always critics.
Yet Moss Hart was a fascinating life. It should have been great.
Incredible life. It had everything going for it, but somehow it didn't come together. But... I thought at least the main title was, I thought the main title worked, so I've always clung to it, and I still occasionally do it when I do film music. I'm with the Oslo Philharmonic. I'm doing a film program with them. And I
oh,
do
really?
This, yeah.
So you're going to play the theme?
I'm going to play the theme.
Will you play
do
it
I
first
dare?
Now?
Do I dare?
Right. You do dare. Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
voila.
What a nice melody. God, we should hear that more often. That's pretty.
The old Hollywood style. That was the end of my Hollywood school. And I put everything in blankets and cried a lot.
Now that's called Theme from
Act
the movie.
One. Act One
is
Act
the title
one.
Of that. Well, when did you get into the conducting end of things? Or
in
had
Hollywood.
You always done it? Still then in Hollywood?
Oh, in Hollywood. I studied with... My first study was, really with Victor Young.
Oh, how great.
But then there was a man by the name of Albert Coates, an English conductor who had severe gout and lived in Hollywood and worked occasionally at the Hollywood Bowl and had a fascinating history, because when Sir Thomas Beecham took his fortune and made, the London Orchestra,
mm-hmm.
the other emerging conductor was Albert Coates, who, alas, had no funds.
Amazing.
And he went to Russia and established an orchestra for the then Tsar, and recorded, as a matter of fact, with that orchestra.
Oh, my goodness.
And did Scriabin, first initial performances of Scriabin, people like that. Anyway, that's who I studied with. And then when I came to New York and went to work at NBC, I studied with Fritz Reiner for quite some time.
I always think that conductors have to have a certain type of personality to be able to stand up there and command all those people. I mean, I would be such a wimp. I could never do a thing like that.
You can't command. You can't command.
Well, what do you do? What's your philosophy?
Persuasion, I suppose.
Persuasion.
There are commanding conductors. I mean, there have been. Not as many now, I don't think. In my opinion, you shouldn't get up there if you don't know which way it's going. You know, it's awful to learn, and all of us are guilty of that, learning at the orchestra's expense. I'm as guilty of it as anybody at one time in my life. But now I generally peer pretty carefully at all the clefs before I stand up there.
Probably a good idea. Listen, how about us trying a duet? We did something at that Carnegie Hall concert.
Yes, we did Moon Indigo.
Yeah, well, let's do that too. But meanwhile, didn't we also do a Gershwin tune?
Sure, we did. It's wonderful.
Let's do that.
Okay. May I give you a vamp, which acquired from a friend of ours of long standing, who I loved very much, Ray Noble.
Oh, he created a special vamp for
this. He had a counter line, which he always loved, and he used to play that, and I'd always get so tickled when he played it, because he was so genteel about everything, you know.
I'm sorry, I never got to meet him.
Ray and Gladys Noble, nice people.
Okay. Thank you. My goodness. While we were doing that, I was just, my mind was roaming around thinking of playing that on Piano Playhouse. Remember that show?
Of course,
Stan
I
Freeman
love that
and,
show.
And Stan Freeman
with Stan and Cy Walter.
Cy Walter.
Yes.
And that was the first radio show I ever did, and I was a nervous wreck. Just being on radio, I mean, not having to say anything, I was shaking like a leaf.
That was a wonderful show. I missed that show all of my life. I've always missed it. That was so, it was so civilized.
Wasn't it, though?
Yes.
Yeah.
Radio had few moments like that. I mean, I did great commercial radio. I worked in the orchestra with Skinny Ennis on the Bob Hope.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, on the Bob Hope show. I worked, Claude Thornhill and I were the piano team with Skinny Ennis.
Oh, what a wonderful player, Claude Thornhill.
What a madman.
I bet you could tell some stories about him.
Well, if you allow me, I'm going to play a tune of Jerry Kern's later called All the Things You Are.
Okay.
But if you'll allow me, I will tell one story about Claude. Mr. Kern wanted to hear his music played like he wrote it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
No suspensions. He wanted. And everything he played, when he played for you, everything was a foxtrot. You know, if it was a ballad, this is the way he played it.
Now, isn't that amazing with these gorgeous melodies that man wrote?
Yeah, that's the way he interpreted.
Wow.
And Claude and I had what they said at that time was probably 8 bars, but it was for 2 pianos in the orchestra, for 2 pianos playing very fanciful variations of All the Things You Are. And Claude, as was his wont, when we got on the air, improvised far and above what we had ever rehearsed. And we were stood in the corner by Mr. Castellanos afterwards and Mr. Kern about scurrying with his melodies, you know. At first, it was the first radio performance of All the Things You Are.
And you did it on the radio. I mean, he had to put up with it.
You couldn't take it back.
Oh.
It wasn't on tape or anything. It was the broadcast.
Well, now, after you were talking all this fascinating stuff about Jerome Kern, why don't you go ahead and play All the Things You Are?
Okay.
I mean, for real, not his way.
Yeah. That was from a show called Very Warm for Me, which featured, of all people, Louis Armstrong. Thank you. Jerry Kern.
Well, that was really pretty, and there's like a little suggestion of the verse in there, too.
Dee-da-da-da-dee-da-da-da. That's a great, great verse. He wrote such incredible melodies. You, when I came to the studio, you were playing the beginning of, I think, almost my all-time favorite melody, because it's a sonata to me. It shouldn't have a lyric, and that's Yesterday.
Oh,
Kern.
Oh.
Yesterday.
Well, see, I suppose if he was playing it, he'd want it to be.
Sure.
Well, if I play it, he probably wouldn't like the way I'm going to play it.
Well, we won't tell him.
Okay.
Wherever he is, he's happy, but we won't tell him.
All right.
That's the best song, construction-wise. I mean, everything.
Isn't it?
It's like a music lesson.
Yeah.
It's a sonata. It's not a song. It should never be sung.
It's got such a nice lyric, though.
It is, yeah.
Such a
meaningful, yeah.
Meaningful lyric. But it's funny, a lot of players, I'm one of them, too, play it as an up-tune.
Yeah.
Anyway. All this reminiscing is almost more than I can stand. My guest is Skitch Henderson. I'm Marion McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz. when you were with the Johnny Carson show.
Yes. I started the Tonight Show actually with Steve Allen. When we started it in, I've forgotten, I think it was 57 or 58, something like that.
I was at the Hickory House, and I was one of the people who used to come over there and do
The Hudson Theater. We were at the old Hudson Theater.
Sure, that's probably where I met you.
And that's when Steve Allen really began playing piano. You know?
Yeah, well, that was one of the sort of...
And he played, and he played, and he played, and he played. Oh, you had to play with him. Yeah,
right, that right. Was it. Yeah, I can remember so many... we'd come in with the trio, and we'd do a number with the trio,
then he'd
mosey over to the other piano. Just so happened.
B-flat blues.
And then we'd play. Yes. Well, we played a few tunes, because... we played Tifa too. I seem to remember that, among other things. But it was a good experience. I mean, it was a lot of fun to go over there and get let loose from the Hickory House for an hour or so.
Yeah.
And plus, of course, great publicity across the country.
It's funny how that show emerged. Then I took a hiatus. I resumed my career with longer hair, as they say. And I went back to Europe and worked with the BBC and worked with the LSO and had a recording series with them. And then worked with the Rundfunk in Stuttgart and Hamburg. And then when the Parr series fell apart, Mort Werner, who was then the executive of that department at NBC, rang me up and said, why don't you come back and hold the fort with Hugh Downs till we decide what we're going to do? And then they picked Carson to be the host, and they traded me. Carson wanted John Scott Trotter, which would have been wonderful. You know, he wanted John Scott Trotter as the so-called foil, as the band leader. And they traded me, the houseman, for Dick Carson, his brother, to be the director. I should write a book about this. But
boy, you should.
This is the truth. This is how things happen, folks.
Oh, it's
so
interesting.
So that's how I stayed. And the first space of it wasn't too comfortable, but eventually we all became friends. And I stayed with the show all the time. They did the New York habit, as we say.
Listen, we've got to play something, and then you've got to go on and talk about more about this, because it's fascinating.
Okay.
But let's do our Mood Indigo that we did.
I'd love it.
Okay.
Okay. I'll play an intro in B-flat, may I?
Yeah.
And then you come whenever you wish. You be the strength.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
nice.
I loved that. It was a lot of fun. I think Duke would have liked that version.
I would hope so.
Yeah. You know, back to the Tonight Show. I was just thinking of something. I meant to bring this today for you, and I forgot it. I have some pictures of us on the Tonight Show with Benny Goodman.
That was very interesting because, you know, I hackled Benny to come and do the show because I said, you know, the band has everybody there at that played for you at one time or another. And it was such a who's who, that band, at that period.
It was.
Doc and Clark and Jimmy Maxwell and Will Bradley. I mean, it was
Will
just...
Will Bradley, oh my God.
Jaime Scherzer, you know, playing lead alto. Tommy Newsom, I mean, some of the guys that are still with Doc or were that I brought into the band in the initial days. And Benny heckled me so about it, you know. He said, well, man, I guess, you know, Pops.
Pops, yeah.
Well, you
Everybody's
put together
Pops.
He said, I'd rather have four saxophones and five brass, though. I'd rather have the old Fletcher arrangements. And I said, well, I don't know where to get those if you want to bring them to me. No, well, then, Pops, I got to rehearse. So I said, well, then pick what you'd like to do. And then he asked, you know, if you'd come in and play piano.
I guess we had this tour going.
Yeah.
It was in 1960-something.
Yeah.
But I remember something that was so funny. Like, Benny stood, you know, when the cameras were on, Benny stood right in front of me. And Johnny said, Benny, move over. Nobody can see Marion. Yeah. And I always thank him for that because, you know.
May I say an adjunct to that?
Yes, you may.
It's about 4 or 5 years later after that show, and I'm touring Australia as a conductor, and I'm in Brisbane. And Brisbane is like an early Denver. It's a quiet city, you know, beautiful, but very quiet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sitting in my hotel room after. They have quite a good radio orchestra there. And I'd rehearsed in the afternoon, and it's about 5:30. And the phone rings in my room. And the following conversation ensues. Now, remember, we're in Brisbane. We're not in Des Moines or, you know, Hackensack. Hey, Pops, you have any spare braces? That was it. Not hello, how are you?
Braces, you mean suspenders.
Suspenders. Yeah. Hey, Pops, you have any spare braces? And he really talked to me as though I would bring them over to his. He was at another hotel. He played in a wrestling arena, which there were no great halls in Brisbane. And it was fascinating because I took the woodwind players from the orchestra when they realized that I knew him. And I took two or three of them to see him. And it was one of Benny's nights that you're very familiar with when he was disgruntled with who was on the stand with him.
Oh, yes.
So they sat on the stand, as you did with Benny, you know.
Oh, yes.
And did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And Benny noodled around with drums and bass till the audience became less than cheery about it. Now, Aussies aren't too subtle, and they drink beer when they're, you know, in a great state over there. It was wonderful to me to watch it. Anyway, after it's over, I went back, and he handed me my soaked braces. They were soaking wet, of course. And then I said, Benny, I've never been able to really say much to you musically, but I said, I just have to tell you that the night that you did the Tonight Show with that band, because the band was at its height then, mm-hmm. it really was, mm-hmm. and they were all still speaking to each other. It was a wonderful climate. I said, that was, to me, one of the night. I have very few happy memories from the telly. But that really made me smile that night. Now, we're sitting in Brisbane in this stinky dressing room where the wrestlers change, and it's 100 degrees in the shade, as Brisbane is. And he just looks at me. There's a dead silence. And he said, yeah, Pops, but it didn't swing.
Oh.
And if that isn't, you know, the statement from the master. And then he went to a diatribe with me again about he had just toured with the English band. He had an English band for a while with four saxophones. He'd gone back to the old book, four saxophones and five brass. And he said, Pops, that really swings. Your thing is too big. It doesn't swing.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I won't go into it, but there's so many things that happened. I mean, I'm a little relieved to hear this because at the time I thought I was the only one that was getting this treatment, these looks and this. Oh. In fact, I did wind up one night, I said to him, well, if you don't like my playing, why did you hire me? And he said, I'm damned if I know.
Oh, for heaven's sake, yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, let's play something.
What do you want to do?
How about a nice English tune, These Foolish Things?
Oh, great.
Okay. Thank you.
wrote that?
Sentimental.
Who wrote that?
Here we are.
Yeah.
Jack Strachey, if that's
Strachey,
the right. Strachey? S-T-R-A-C-H-E-Y, if that's the right.
A singular hit, was it? Or did he write other?
That's the only one I know of. I guess that's where I first heard it was in England and learned it off the BBC, as I did with most of the tunes I know.
I tried to think where I remember it as long as I've worked, strangely enough. You
me
know?
Too.
So it must have been, you know, it would have been written, what, in the 30s then, I suppose.
I guess. I don't know if it was from a show or,
It must have been a show an in-one song of some kind, you know, because it's such a poignant.
Isn't it?
Lyric.
Just beautiful. Skitch, I was thinking before, you started to tell me a story about how you really got started from your early days in Minnesota. Mm-hmm.
Well, my father sent me to the States to live with an aunt there, and I wasn't too ecstatic with life there. And in a moment of sheer folly, I took off. And I ended up playing with, I don't know how I ever got there, but I ended up playing with really what they used to call territory bands.
Mm-hmm.
And we were playing at a hotel, I think the Broadmoor in Denver, playing dinner music. You know, you used to play from 7 to 9:30 or something.
Oh, yeah,
and they fed you and paid you, what, 28 bob a week or something
mm-hmm.
like that. And your room,
mm-hmm.
yeah, with a roommate or maybe two roommates, you know. There was no privacy. And a troupe came through from MGM promoting Andy. It was the beginning of the Andy Hardy series. And a manager his name was Frank Perquette, and he had in tow with him two very young people, one by the name of Judy Gum, who became Judy Garland, of course, and the other was Mickey Rooney, whose father, Joe Yule, had somewhat of a name.
Yeah, he was a comic, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, a burlesque comic.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on the road with the picture for MGM, and they'd go in front of the traveler, in front of the screen, and Judy would sing, and Mickey would do 16 bars of Soft Shoe or something and do a couple of jokes, and then they'd say how wonderful this picture was you were going to see.
I never saw anything like that. How terrific.
Yeah, that was it. That was the beginning. And this was in the late 30s. And that's the old Hollywood story. The pianist who was sent on the road with them became ill the first day and could not work after the opening show or the open. They were there 3 days, I think. And the manager of the theater said, there's a kid plays in a band down at the hotel, and he can read music. That was the whole criteria.
And he could read music.
That I could read. I don't know how he knew it, but I could read. And, you know, 20 minutes later, I was on the road with MGM. And when we finished the tour, we finished in Chicago, and Mr. Perquette said, where are you going? And I said, I don't know. You know. He said, well, I got to have an open-end ticket. It was train, of course, at that time. He said, why don't you come to Hollywood? So I got on the train with no brains at all, went to Hollywood. They got off at Glendale because that was what you did in those days. You didn't, got off at Glendale for pictures. And, of course, they got off at Glendale and left me standing in the dark night, and that was my beginnings.
So you really knew Judy and Mickey intimately then as
kids?
Oh,
from the beginnings, yes.
How great.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, listen, we'd better play before.
Yes.
Oh, I'll play. I'll play something I was just thinking about while we were talking. I think we talked about composers that only write one hit.
Oh, big hits.
And this particular tune, I think he might have written another one. This Ben Oakland is his name, and he wrote I'll Take Romance.
Yes. Oh.
All right, here goes.
Thank you.
What a song.
Isn't that a nice song?
Yeah. Viennese in a funny way, you know?
So many,
yeah.
So many.
Hard to write waltzes. Like Richard Rodgers' Lover. I mean, waltzes like that.
Now, that's one of the great
classic
waltzes, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
One of the great ones. You know, this is, we haven't even started doing anything or talking and what we have, but I mean, time's up. Isn't that awful?
Well, that's healthy. I hope we didn't abuse anybody's privileges.
I don't think we did. In fact, well, our time isn't really up because it'd be nice to do one more tune, but I mean, this is the last tune, and I can't tell you what a ball I'm having.
That's
just
nice.
Talking.
Well, you know, I know you, and I love you, and I'm glad for your integrity of this show, too. I'm a worrywart who travels on the road, so I get to hear you from places other than, you know, the comfort of my farm. So
see, well, now, next time, you'll get to hear you from someplace on the road.
I'll run. Shall we do some Gershwin?
Yeah, let's. Huh? Okay, Fascinating Rhythm.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Better put a major triad for Gershwin. He would like.
Well, that's a great way to end the show. Thanks, Gitch.
Pleasure.
I loved it.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with Marianne McPartland and her guest from 1992's Gitch Henderson. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Andrew Milano, mastering engineer Bill Sexton, executive producer Bill Hay. We love to hear from you. Our email address is pj@scetv.org. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the Friends of Piano Jazz, NPR member stations, and NPR. Support for this episode's original production was provided by Exxon Corporation. Support for the digital archiving of Piano Jazz was provided by Save America's Treasures through a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service Department of the Interior. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR contributors, which include the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.